Good morning and welcome to Bookends, a podcast from the Team Approach featuring books for leaders and human resource and organizational development consultants. I'm Susan Stamm and I'm pleased to welcome Peter Block to our show today, whose newest book is Community, The Structure of Belonging. To order a copy of this book, you can visit www.designedlearning.com where you will find rich resources, articles, assessments, and more. Peter Block is an author, consultant, and citizen of Cincinnati, Ohio. He is a partner in Design Learning, a training company that offers workshops designed to build skills that are outlined in his books. He wrote the seminal book on OD consultation, Flawless Consulting, recognized by the Organization Development Network with the 2004 Members Choice Award for the most influential book for OD practitioners over the last 40 years. He recently was honored with the OD Network Lifetime Achievement Award. His book, Community, The Structure of Belonging, came out in May of 2008. Peter has authored several other best-selling books about ways to create workplaces and communities that work for all. They offer an alternative to the patriarchal beliefs that dominate our culture. He works to bring change into the world through consent and connectedness rather than through mandate and force. With other volunteers, Peter has begun a small group, which is a network of citizens engaged in the restoration of their community through the powerful tool of civic engagement. And you can visit a website about this work at www.asmallgroup.net. Peter Block, welcome.
Well, thank you. I got to shorten that introduction. Other than the book.
Don't be so humble. We're really impressed with your work and eager to talk with you this morning. So, Peter, you begin your book, Community, by sharing insights and models from a number of thought leaders who've influenced you and your work. And I found many of these ideas fascinating and wondered if we might be able to take a little time to review a few that seem to really form an important backdrop to this particular book. And I'd like to begin with John McKnight. In a section titled Associational Life, you discuss McKnight's thoughts about systems and service, and I found this really interesting. Could you highlight some of his thinking for us?
Well, John has spent 30 years discussing and researching community, like what makes for community a sense of belonging, a sense of connectedness, what are the functions of communities, and what he discovered was that communities have become rather incompetent, that our capacity together to solve human problems has been our capacity to be replaced by professional service systems. And so if he looks at people who are poor, who are not healthy, who struggle in life, they're well-serviced people, and he's come to the conclusion that systems, organizations, job and family services, are incapable of really solving these problems. And his basic stance is that people in association with each other are the ones who really solve most human problems, not professionals. And so he makes a big argument against against the service economy, and he says, why don't we reclaim for ourselves our ability to raise a child, to educate a child, to help troubled people? He's looked at the disabilities movement and find that most people with disabilities really need a circle of support and friends around them. They don't need more professional paid care. So it's a pretty radical thought.
Yeah.
And it kind of resonates with people. Can a school educate my child? They can teach my child, but there's so much more to raising a child than the school can do. And we've kind of we've outsourced these functions.
It's pretty particularly interesting to me since I started my career in the human service industry. It was a whole new way of looking at these things, and I certainly would agree with John McKnight's thoughts about this. And I also read with great interest the insights that you shared from Werner Eckhart, I'm sorry, Earhart, yes, particularly his discussion on context and how we can actually choose a context that works for us. I just thought this was just a fabulous idea and really great news. In fact, I was cheering when I read this part of the book. Could you tell us a little bit about his thinking about context and our choice around this?
Yeah, well, the headline is Context is Decisive. So his work, which is very well known, is that we decide how the world shows up for us. So if I look at and I look at any scene I want, that I'm deciding what I see there. Mm-hmm. And so how I see it, if I see it as dangerous, as safe, if I see it as impacts my response, my behavior. Economics is probably the simplest way to understand it. Right now we have a context in terms of an economy that says scarcity is value.
Mm-hmm.
And we only give value to what's scarce, and some people are questioning that context and say, why don't we decide economics of abundance, of gifts? And so the technical, understandable term is social construction, that I decide how I view the world, and I can view it as possibilities, or all I can see is problems. Another simple way is a glass half full or half empty.
Yeah.
And what Warner's done is underlined that is critical. And my use of that idea is that if I look at my city, my urban center, I live in Cincinnati, in my community, is it dangerous? Is it in decline? Is downtown difficult? And we've told the story of Cincinnati, that it's an unsafe place,
mm-hmm.
like Detroit and every city. And so I'm trying to change the context within which we view our kind of urban life. But it's a powerful idea, and it says that if I can just shift my worldview or my way of seeing or my lens, that is the key to my transformation and changing my relationship to my life.
Mm-hmm. Really powerful ideas.
No small thing.
No.
Just elusive.
Yes. and very difficult, you know, in the times that we live in to help enough people to move in that direction.
Exactly, because if you read the public narrative,
mm-hmm.
the newspapers, the blogs, the TV,
mm-hmm.
all have a context of problems.
Yeah.
Of conflict, of what's wrong with the world. And most of that stuff I don't even have to know about. Somebody got killed in my city. It's not useful for me to know about that. What am I going to do? Decide that I shouldn't go out of the house?
Right, right.
Well, that's very powerful.
I frequently put myself on a news diet and just don't allow myself to, because it's just so negative.
You have to. You don't want to. I would get rid of the AM radio band if I could. Because the whole conversation is what's wrong with somebody else.
Yeah. Yeah.
Nobody takes accountability. Part of the intent of the book is to try to shift the context in which we view our communities and create places where people are accountable.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, here's my choice. Anyway, it's a big thing. It's just hard to reach.
Yeah, it's huge. And finally, one more of these folks that you talk about in the very beginning of your book, that kind of lays this context out for us for the entire book is Peter Kostenbaum. Am I pronouncing his name correctly?
Yeah.
And he suggests that perhaps the real task of leadership, and I just love this, the real task of leadership is to confront people with their freedom. Wow. And this just gives you so much to think about. It's just such a big idea. Could you share a few of Peter's thoughts about freedom, accountability, and what he calls the appreciating paradox?
Well, it's a big idea. You're right. It's been working on me for about 15 years. And I write about it in hopes that I'll understand it. But basically, he says that who we are is a human freedom. That I cannot be explained by my past, my genes, my environment, my parents, my peers. All the explanations we have for why people are the way they are cover everything but the fact that we come in as a free choice. And as soon as you get that, then that I will be accountable for the world the moment I realize that I've helped create it.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's just it's enormously liberating. It has one small problem, and it scares the hell out of us. You know, and so the price you pay for your freedom is anxiety. And the other thing, Peter, and so if you're anxious, it means you're on track.
Well, I guess I'm on track.
You're doing good. You're supposed to wake up in the middle of the night.
Mm-hmm.
All right? It's not a problem to be solved. You don't need a doctor or diagnosis or McKnight's Human Services. If you're anxious, it means you're paying attention. And you have choice. And the other point is that certainty is a denial of the reality of life. That life is paradoxical. It's ambivalent. It's confusing. And somehow if I can accept that, then it gives me enormous room in which to move rather than looking for the right answer. And there's nothing more dangerous than to productive community or organization than the belief that there's one way. And so it's an argument against fundamentalism, which is probably the cause of most of the violence and suffering in the world.
Boy, do I agree with you there. I just tend to think that a lot of us work against these ideas throughout most of our lives. We just fight this. We want answers. We want black and white.
We want safety.
And we want safety, exactly.
You know what I'd give up for my safety? I'd give up my sovereignty.
Yeah.
I'd give up ownership of my life.
And didn't we as a nation a few years ago, you really move, take huge strides in that very direction?
Well, this culture, yeah, it's a wish for dominance. It says that the way we'll be better off, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness will be better served as an imperial nation.
Mm-hmm.
And it has nothing to do with liberal versus conservative, or right versus left.
Mm-hmm.
In some ways, it's ultra-conservative. To go back to the notion that people have a right to choose, including countries, who they want to become.
Lots to think about there. Wow. In chapter 2,
big ideas, don't you?
I do, but they do keep me up all night.
You're an exception.
Well,
settle for what's simple, will you?
No, never, unfortunately. We call it the idea curse in our family, and unfortunately we all suffer from it.
That's great. Well, luckily there's only four of us, so don't worry about it.
Oh my. Well, moving a little further into your book, you get into, in chapter 2, you start to lay out the context for community building, and once again I was cheering as I was reading your comment that the small group, you know, not the people in the ivory tower, but the small group is the unit of transformation. And I've always felt that this is true. What are your thoughts about, you know, top-down and transformation initiatives that we see today?
There's two things here. One is, where does cause reside?
Mm-hmm.
Is it in leadership? Is it in the boss, the CEO? Is Obama going to save us?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And so all the evidence I can see about if you want something to change, where cause resides is in lower levels among citizens, among employees, in systems among first and second, third level supervisors. I've never hardly ever seen anything really change that was initiated from the top. Not because of who they are, it's just that positionally they're too isolated from what's going on close to the customer or the bottom or the edge to know really what needs to change. And so now the other thing is the question of scale. See, high control systems we have to take it to scale. We have to affect large numbers of people quickly as an argument against participative process. Everybody says participation takes too long. And from what I can see, any places that have really changed themselves have started one small group at a time. The largest social movements on the earth started with somebody in one place with 10 people deciding something's got to change. If you look at the Grameen Bank, which has changed, you know, the micro-lending practices in Bangladesh for millions of people. For years, it was 8 people, 16 people. And so if anybody reading the book wants something to really change and be sustainable over time, you focus on small groups, 6, 8, 10 people, really figuring something out, really getting committed, meeting together and creating for themselves what they want to see in the world. You don't go to the CEO or the president or the executive director or the president of the United States and say, here's what you ought to be doing to get all those people involved. Those processes create 10 times more resistance than support. And so it's a, you know, Margaret Mead said it, you know, that all social change begins with a small group. And it's just a whole different, and it also gives all of us something to do. When we say the top needs to do it in a wide, it lets us off the hook and nothing's going to change.
Yeah. And you know, you of course mentioned Obama in your comments there. And, you know, how do we get a nation of people to recognize their responsibility and ownership? Do you have any thoughts about, you know?
He may get that. Mm-hmm. You know, he's working as hard after the campaign to sustain mm-hmm. the volunteerism and participation that he had during the campaign.
Yeah.
Now, we have to do our part. And, you know, of course what he does matters, because he affects context. If he fulfills his promise, he will shift the context. He'll say, we're going to start working with other countries. We're going to start caring again. You know, there's a wonderful book by Nelson Algren wrote in praise of small men. And he had a quote in there that he was interviewing some mine worker or something. And the guy said, you know, President Roosevelt is the only president of the United States that recognized that my boss was a son of a gun. So I think the context that the worker, the people at the bottom, the people that are vulnerable, should be the center of our attention.
Mm-hmm.
So he can do that, but then we have to decide what kind of neighborhood we want.
Yes.
Do we want to care for our neighbors? I mean, the solution to health care is prevention, support groups, all the research on how people stay healthy. It means they do it by prevention and with others.
Mm-hmm.
All the healing methodologies for people with a margin or a trouble say that it's our interdependence that heals us. It's not professional intervention. It's not drugs, chemicals. So hopefully he'll keep confronting us with what we need to do. And then all it takes is 15 or 20% of us to get together and decide we're not going to go on like we've been going on and something's going to change. But
yeah.
Whether it does or not is somebody else's hands, basically.
And I think, you know, a lot of us probably are really hopeful that maybe the pendulum is really beginning to swing, because I don't think that there's ever been a time where people have been so disconnected.
I know. That's why I wrote the book.
Yeah, and certainly.
And the purpose of the book is to try to concretize this. You know, the beginning of the book is what we're talking about. But then I said, well, you know, there's some incredibly simple things we can do every time we get together that make a huge difference. The weakness of the book. If I was going to knock the book, I would just say it's too simple.
Yeah.
Come on. Get real. It's too simple and too idealistic. Give me something longer, thicker, and harder to read.
Or a checklist.
I know. I could come to that, though. My mommy.
Yes. Wouldn't that be nice? In Chapter 2, you also share insights about stories, our personal stories, and how these can be really useful or limiting. And I was thinking about this, you know, primarily from the context, and I know it certainly has a context within communities. I remember growing up in a steel town and how the stories about, you know, the steel plant who my father and grandfather and great-grandfather all worked for owed me a living. It was kind of the mindset of that community during the late 70s when, you know, things were changing in that industry dramatically. But also in organizations. Could you talk about you know, a little bit about these stories and how they can limit us in organizations.
Well, my story, they have a great quote, which is kind of the basis for this. It used to be in the Cold War, but in Russia, even the past is unpredictable. I love that, because most of our stories we've made up. So you have a story, you say, oh, I work for Citibank, I work for, you know, the city, and you don't know what it's like around here. You hear this all the time. If you stand up, you get shot. Well, 3 years ago, somebody did. Well, they're not open. They're resistant to change. Well, unless top management gets it, you know, there's nothing you can do around here unless you start at the top. Well, our department's fine, but marketing, it doesn't have their head screwed on straight until marketing gets it together. So if you listen in on people's conversations and meetings, most of the time they're talking about someone else being the cause of the problem. And unless they change or unless they report to us, we always think if we were czar, it would be better. And so those are all stories. And in my mind, they're all fiction. They're just what I've constructed for some reason. Even my story, how I grew up, my family, you know, all that are stories. Now, they're interesting, and sometimes they're revealing. So if I hear you talk about 3-4 generations in the steel plant, interesting, it tells me maybe something about it, but it doesn't define who you are.
Right.
And it's not powerful. If I'm interested in creating a different future, those stories become a limitation. And until I get the fact that they've just been constructed and that they don't define who I am, who you are is not the daughter of 4 generations of steel workers. Because if it wasn't, if that was true and the steel plant shut down, where does that leave you?
Exactly.
Do you start over again? Or do you go through life feeling I was, my heritage was stolen from me? So the key is to get out of the notion that my story has anything to do with who I am. I am a bundle of commitments. I'm a bundle of choice. I'm a bundle of gifts. And so you have to help people see the limitations of their stories if they're going to create space for something new to show up in their life. And communities are really strong. Cincinnati has a story of itself. It's pretty grim. I mean, our heroes are Pete Rose, Larry Flint, Jerry Springer. What do I do with that?
Yeah.
You know, that's not who this city is. You know, so there's just a lot in the story thing. Well, and while they're interesting and revealing, they're not powerful. You have to give it up and say, well, I'm paying a price for the story I have about the place that I care about.
Great stuff. I really enjoyed that piece of the book. You be moving along into the next section. You talk about the stuck community, and you paint a really accurate picture, I think, of all of our sins, at least in this country and probably a lot of the rest of the world, from marketing fear to ramping up laws and romanticizing leadership. I loved your ideas on leadership. I just couldn't underline enough in Chapter 3. Would you walk us through some of the ideas that challenge our conventional thinking, that you discussed in this area of the book?
Well, you're going to make me look and see what Chapter 3 was.
Well, you were talking about,
Let me respond to the question. Mm-hmm. And that basically, there's an inversion required that most of the messages that we get, you know, are fear-based messages. And we have a set of beliefs that somehow when something goes wrong, a new policy, a new procedure, a new law, a new rule, more jails, that there's some kind of retributive response to the world that will be useful. And so when there's an accident, it triggers more oversight. And it's this basic belief that somehow tightening control creates a more positive future that I'm trying to question. And I'm trying to invert where cause resides, that somehow if the future is going to be different, I have to change my mind and realize that citizens create leaders, and students create teachers. And my children created me. I've involved this with 6 kids. And there's nothing I can connect between what I did in raising them and how they turned out. And so it's really trying to say, well, let me shift my thinking about where cause is, and let me stop believing that a deficiency orientation and retributive responses to it are all useful in eliminating the problems that we've got. So if I've got a problem with youth or crime or health or environment or transportation or education, focusing on those problems isn't going to make a difference. That's what we've been doing for 50 years. And so I've got to shift the orientation and say that I want to view the possibilities and the gifts that exist in a certain situation. And out of that, something can change. So if I see youth on the street corner during the day, during school hours, instead of saying those are youth at risk, why don't I decide to see them as possibilities? Why don't I say those kids have gifts that they don't know how to deliver, and that's why they're up to mischief? They don't know how to be useful in their lives. And so it's just a whole shift. And soon as then that shifts my action. If I think that way, I say, well, how do I find out what their gifts are? I got an idea. Let me go talk to them. Hi, how are you? What do you like to do? And this is true with youth. It's true with people who are disabled. It's true with people who are mentally ill. It's true with employees at the first level. And so we just have such a deficiency mindset, and we've lost such faith in the capacity of people who aren't in power that it keeps us frozen. It does keep us frozen.
I'd love to see us apply those same kinds of ideas to people who we've labeled as terrorists in this world as well.
Thank you. I know. Ultimately, we're going to make peace. I've done a fair amount of work in Northern Ireland. And so they have been 35 years into warfare between the two sides, the Orangemen and the IRA. And sooner or later, you know. Now, they did make peace. They met in jail is how the peace got started. And the guys from both sides met in jail, at some point they said, do we want our grandchildren to meet like we are?
Wow.
Really? And they said no. And when they got out, they said, we're going to work something out.
Amazing.
So if you look at the Palestinians or the Middle East or people we call terrorists, you know, we're going to work something out with these countries sooner or later. Why don't we do it now?
I agree.
And the Iraqis and Iranians, that's not who they are. I mean, there are people doing awful things, but there's people doing awful things all over the world.
Sure there are.
And why don't we look at causes instead of using that as an excuse for more internal retribution? And I read somewhere, I don't think I read it before I finished the book, but that somehow there's a combination of imperialism abroad requires repression at home. And once we decide that we know what's good for other countries, inevitably we're going to live in a more high-control, repressive, wall-building country internally. That's what's going to kill us.
Yeah, I completely, completely agree.
Yeah.
Wow. Kindred spirit.
And the kind of ultra-conservatism. Yes. About taking care of business and stop this notion that we are an imperial and colonial power. That's what's killing us.
Yeah. In talking about the restorative community, you talk a little bit about the importance of language and the difference between accountability and entitlement. We've already talked a little bit about some of this earlier. Would you just discuss these two ideas just a little bit? And if you can recall, Peter, you share an example which I thought was really powerful. It was, I believe, called the Claremont Counseling Center.
And I can do that. You're worried about me remembering the book. A little nervous.
No. But
you write a book to get rid of ideas. Be patient with me.
I am. Go for it.
Okay. So restoration is to think about. So what do we do about this? Most of the book is about that. And it says that, well, the way we come together, the way we speak, dictates the future we create. And so the idea that all transformation is linguistic also came from Warner, or got crystallized by him. And so how do we shift our and begin using language that's powerful, not just interesting? And so language about entitlement, here's what's due me, here's the reparations, here's what those people should be doing. All that language is satisfying because it lets me off the hook, but it's not powerful. So the book is about six conversations that have the power to create a future. I listed six just because people like six. They like numbers. You know, there could be four or seven, but six I could remember, seven I couldn't. And you can tell memory is becoming an issue for me. And so the conversations of ownership, of possibility, of commitment, conversations of gifts and invitation and dissent that are outlined in the book. These conversations, as soon as we have them, something shifts in us and between us. As soon as you and I talk about what promise we're willing to make instead of what deal we want to make, something changes in the speaking. And so that's basically, that's what's restorative. If we start talking about what we want to create, start talking about our gifts, our commitments, our possibilities, instead of our problems and deficiencies. The Claremont Counseling Center has a group called Phoenix Place, dealing with people who are recovering from mental illness. Now, most people with mental illness are well-serviced people. We think we need professionals. We think we need counselors and therapists and group. And we need to isolate them and warehouse them in with people like themselves. And all of that has use. But basically, Phoenix Place says, why don't we focus on the gifts and capacities of people and help them learn that in the face of their recovery from mental illness, they have things they do well. I mean, really well. And so Phoenix Place has a leadership team of its members. So Meg runs the place, but her team are members, people recovering from mental illness. And their discussion is, so what can you do? And so some of them are good at intake. They know how to interview other mentally ill people, and so they're in charge of intake. Others are good at cleaning up and creating order in the place. And it's just a whole, so they come there, it's not a residential, but they come there during the day, and they participate in running the treatment center of which they are a participant.
It's amazing.
Client. It's amazing. And when you're with them, you realize they have enormous gifts. For example, they listen. We've been having meetings that include them, and when they sit next to me, they look at me, they make eye contact, and they don't feel compelled to speak like I do. They're not out there to make a point. They have enormous empathy. They have an enormous intuition. They have enormous listening capacities. And so it's just again, this is a great example of where the context that Mag creates and Claremont create in that place is, if you come here, we're interested in your gifts. If you take a diagnostic questionnaire with us, it's going to be about what your gifts and your strengths are. One of them said, I think I put this in the book, it's the first time I've ever taken a test. I scored well on.
Yes, I love that.
God, it just breaks your heart. And it's not that they don't have deficiencies. I do have deficiencies. I got some great ones, and I've spent years perfecting them. But focusing on them isn't useful. It doesn't get rid of them. And so that Phoenix Place is a great example of that.
Yeah, it really is. And even just the language of recovering from mental illness is such a powerful, you know.
That's the language they've chosen to describe themselves.
Yeah, it's great.
And aren't we all?
Yeah. Yes, we are. Thank you.
<You're welcome. laughs>
There have been many voices over the past few years that have expressed the concern that here, at least in this country, I don't think we're unique to this problem, however, that we are becoming a nation of consumers. And I love in your bio, you know, the fact that you point out that you are a citizen of your community. Your chapter about this is, I think, really excellent. And I wonder, do you feel that we no longer are a nation of citizens here in the U.S.? And what would you say it means to become a citizen? And are there places in the world maybe that people still are citizens?
Well, I think we are totally consumers. It's our, all of our measures are consumers. Mm-hmm. What was the mandate after 9/11?
Oh, yeah.
Shop.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not only who I am and my mindset, it's also our economy is organized around retail sales.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody was interested in crisis this Christmas. They were interested in retail sales.
Yeah.
That's what all the headlines were. And so we've organized our belief system that consumerism is the key to the good life. And it's fairly recent. It's the last, I don't know, 60 years where we marketed needs. And when the going gets tough, the tough go shopping. So we very much now, what that means at a human level is that I now think I have to purchase what I require. I'm no longer able to produce it. So a citizen is somebody who can produce satisfaction for themselves and who has the belief that maybe what I have is enough, both in my own capacities and the things that I have. And so citizenship is the belief that this neighborhood, community, country is mine to create, and I have the tools and capacities and gifts to produce that. I don't need to depend on a mall or a set of services or a set of doctors or anybody who's... I've just had a good friend pass away. And so I've been close to the hospital system for 2 weeks. And you don't, if you're looking for help, that's not where you want to go.
No.
Not. And so it's a you know, profound notion that to be a citizen is simply someone who can produce their own satisfaction. And it don't have to, it doesn't mean I can do it alone. I can't. I need a neighbor. I need a family. I need an extended family. I need a community to produce that. But we, together, through association, can produce whatever we want, whether it's the care for our child, whether it's safety for our neighborhood, health, environment. And so that's what citizenship is. Now, you do find it. Some of us grew up in it. You know, if you're over 50, you might remember where your family was all in one place, and most of what you did, you knew how to entertain yourself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so in less developed countries, you still find citizens.
Mm-hmm.
You still find neighborhoods. Now, we call them subsistence economies.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're trying to modernize them.
This
is globalization is a fancy word.
Mm-hmm.
We're making them like us. We're exporting a consumer economy, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And so there are places, and when you go to less developed countries, you find real neighborhoods.
Right.
You find people that only shop when they need something. They don't shop for recreation.
Yeah.
And they aren't loaded. They don't have 10 different wires hooked up to their body. They get bored. So I would say wherever you find an unwired community, you found some citizens.
Yeah, good. Well, maybe they can export citizenship to those of us that are wired and kind of sucked into the...
I really think so. Because the technology is interesting, but that's all. It's amazing, but so what?
Yeah.
What does that have to do with what I had in mind for my life? Just because I can do something more easily doesn't mean that the quality of it is there. You know?
I think we miss the idea of what does that mean for my life and that kind of thinking. We get so tied into all of the responsibilities that we create for ourselves in our lives so we can be good consumers.
Exactly. I want to write a book. It just all has as a title. But it's called Select All, Delete. You know, it is a whole set of beliefs that somehow I need to accumulate all these things to fulfill my responsibilities. You're exactly right.
Yeah, I'm sure you're well aware of the work of Simplicity Forum and some of those folks. Yeah.
Maker Society.
Yeah.
Market.
Yes.
They've got it right. Yes. You know, possible futures. Slow food, slow eating, slow cooking. All of those things are right on it. So it's not like these ideas don't exist in the world. We just haven't decided they're central.
Yeah.
We think they're just interesting. We call them alternative methodology.
Yeah.
We discount something. We discount it by calling it an alternative, like it's not the real thing. You know, it's alternative medicine. Well, that's not real medicine.
Right, right.
So that's where the language is so powerful.
Yeah.
Why don't I decide that preventative health and what I eat and stuff is medicine? That's the real thing. And once in a while I go to the alternative thing, which is chemicals and drugs.
Well, closely related to all of this conversation that we've been having about citizenship, you get into something a little later in the book that you call leadership is convening. And I thought this was really a powerful idea, and we've touched on this a little bit, but I wonder if we could go just a little further with what this is about. And it's so sad that these ideas are so counter to how we view leadership in most organizations today, certainly most communities, and really even as a nation. We already talked about, you know, some people's expectations of our new president coming in. Can you share some of your thoughts about leadership from you know, this area of the book? And you also shared a really powerful illustration of this with the Finley House.
Yeah. Half the conversation is what leadership isn't. And it takes a big burden off my shoulders if I decide that leadership is not about being dynamic, charismatic, having certain unique characteristics, the 5 C's, the 10 C's, the 7 habits. Leadership is not about being something other than what I am. And so I stopped looking for leaders to have a vision, or being energetic, or speak the hearts and minds of what's in people. And so half of it said, let go of all that, because you and I and others, we are who we are. You know, this is it. This is the package. This is the cards I've been dealt. Why am I so unsatisfied with that? The other is that leadership really is helping citizens or employees come together with each other. So everything I see about how change occurs in the world occurs out of a peer-to-peer relationship. When employees decide to work well together, when neighbors decide to work well together, if you look at healthcare, when a family decides to care for each other and their own health, these are moments of high performance and high transformation. So if that was true, and if I look at Harley Davidson or some of the great examples of companies that changed themselves, saved themselves, it was by building strong teams and strong peer relationships that they achieved that. If that's true, then maybe that's the task of leadership, is simply to bring people together in a new way. And that's what's called the convening capacity. And maybe the task of leadership is more about listening than speaking, and more about questions than answers. And that's where this one project, two friends of mine, Joe and Michael Hoxie, and their kids actually, were hired as social workers, as therapists, to work with 12 inner-city black street kids. And the kids, they said, you want to play basketball? You go and go to this workshop first. That's the price you pay to get on the basketball court. So you had some pretty desperate administrators here. But so they hired Joan to facilitate these kids. And after about 2 hours, Joan and Michael and they realize this is not going well. Zoned out. There's very little eye contact. Their right foot is tapping like crazy on the ground. And so they stopped. And God bless them for having the wisdom to stop their design. You know, they had designed a program on relationship building. And they said, what's up with you guys? And not much. So they met again because the guys wanted to play basketball. What's up with you guys? And after about the third meeting, the guys started talking. They said, well, here's who we are. Here's what our life is. And Joan and Michael and Tom and Jill and the four of them decided we're going to spend 6 months listening and understanding who these people are, who these young people are. And that the more they listened, the more the kids showed up, the more they were on time. They brought them a cake, a culinary bribery. And so the kids knew every time that Joan had baked a cake as an expression of her affection. And for 6 months, they just listened, and they never gave advice. And what happened was they all got connected. They fell in love with each other. These people started to trust Joan and Michael. Michael and Joan started to trust these kids. And something got created, and the kids started to straighten up a little bit. It had an impact on the kids to be seen, understood, valued. That somebody was interested in who they were, not interested in making them better. And what it resulted in, which is even, it's happened since the book came out, but these kids, so Joan and Michael's workshop was over, and they got so much of being together, let's do something together, and it turns out one of these kids had written a script for a movie.
Oh my goodness.
Joe Fraser had written a script, and he'd been sitting on it for a year. And they said, what do you got there, Joe? He says, well, I got this script. It's called The Last Shot. And, you know, one of the thoughts was, let's make a documentary of our process, but there's too many of those.
Yeah.
And they said, and they made the movie. And we just had, on December 28th, we just had the world premiere of a 58-minute movie made by these 15 kids.
Oh, my goodness.
On their own will and their own time, called The Last Shot. And it has changed their lives. They now believe that they have a future. Quite amazing.
Wow. The power of love to transform, isn't it amazing?
It really is, and it came from listening, from saying, let me find out who you are, rather than let me tell you who you should become. So one of the ground rules that it's in the book, is the injunction against advice. I have stopped helping people. And I can't stop giving advice. It's a horrible, one of my deficiencies.
Yeah, me too.
at least I know it's not useful.
Well, that is so, so very powerful. It looks like we're kind of approaching towards the end of our time today, and,
okay.
And I was wondering, to kind of wrap things up for us, and you had just mentioned them much earlier in our conversation, you know, the fact that your model is for these six conversations, and you chose the number for whatever reason, ease of remembering it. But I was wondering if maybe you could just tell us a little bit about those conversations, just to kind of give us a sense of your approach and your model.
Let me give you the, if people got this, they don't have to read the book, okay? So this is let me just tell you the essence of the action part of the book.
Okay.
One is that questions are the point. So you either get really good at questions that are ambiguous, personal, and anxiety-provoking. So what's the question if you had an answer to? What sets you free? It's a great question because I don't know what the heck it means, but it's kind of interesting. The other is that when you bring people together, break them into small groups quickly. Groups of four or five and make them sit with their knees less than 9 inches from the person next to them so they're leaning into each other. A third ground rule is don't give advice, get curious, so ask people why does it matter instead of what are you going to do about it or here's what I would have done. And then the domain in which this kind of circle occurs is a question of, first of all, what's the possibility that you came here to live out? not what's the problem you came here to solve. So this is a possibility conversation. And the best question is, what's the crossroads you're at this stage of your life? There's an ownership question, and the question there is, and all these conversations are triggered by a question. So the ownership question is, what are you doing to contribute to the very thing that you're complaining about? If I can answer that, I can do something.
Yeah.
If I can't answer that, I'm left to a life of complaint and disappointment. A third one is if you can't say no, your yes doesn't mean anything. So the question is, what's the no you've been postponing? What's the yes you gave that you no longer mean? Beautiful questions. Terrifying questions. The commitment conversation is, what's the promise you're willing to make with no expectation of return? So commitment is something I choose. It's an act of generosity. It's not a deal to be made. And the final is, what's the gift that you continue? It's a gift conversation versus decision. What's the gift that you continue to hold in exile? What's the gift given to you that you've not yet fully brought into the world? And one question is, what feedback do you get when you hear it you're still embarrassed by? One of the ground rules when people say something positive to each other is just say thank you.
Yeah.
I like hearing that, because most of us are blind to our gifts. And then the sixth conversation is one of invitation. Now, what's the invitation that you're waiting for? Or what's the invitation you want to make that you've been reluctant to make? Because the world is transformed not by mandate, but by invitation, by people saying, would you join me in this? And then you learn to embody that in all the small ways of how we gather. So when people do break up into small groups, you never count off. You always say, find three people in this room that you know the least and sit in a circle with them and try these questions.
Yeah. Well, I was really intrigued by the process, and of course with some experience and background with World Cafe and Appreciative Inquiry, but I have to admit the questions that you have in your book were extraordinarily powerful. And I really appreciate your taking the time to visit with us today, the gift of your conversation. And
how did it go? What do you think?
I think it went great.
Great. You care about these things.
I do.
Special.
I do care
you're
about
just,
these.
You're not just making a living.
No,
you're doing a job. This is work. This is your work.
Yes.
You have enormous curiosity, and you have a great intuition about the things that matter.
Well,
I feel like you really got this book, and I'm grateful for that.
And I'm grateful for you for writing this book and for sharing these things that are obviously on your mind and heart with us in your work, and certainly through this book. So we'd like to thank you again, and all of us who are here with us today and those who will listen in the future. And I wanted to remind folks once again that if there is interest in purchasing Peter's book, and regardless of whether he says you don't have to read the book after you've heard the interview, I would strongly disagree with that. And I would like to encourage you to visit his website, which is once again www.designedlearning.com, designedlearning.com. In February, I wanted to remind folks that I will be visiting with Kim Cameron, who will be discussing a book that he has written, which is called Positive Leadership. And to remind you that if you would like to always be in the know about our book and interviews, which occur on a monthly basis, that you can go to our website, teamapproach.com, and sign up for the notifications to receive what's happening on bookends. There's a button there on the site for you to do that, and we'd love to have you join us again in the future. So once again, we want to thank you, Peter Block, for being our wonderful guest today and for sharing your time with us.
Thank you. If anybody wants, my email is pbi@att.net, so
and
I love hearing from people.
Sometimes it's a little hard to distinguish between a D and a B. Would you go through that one more time?
B is in Block.
So it's PB for Peter Block, and then the D, I.
@att.net, or however, I'm reachable, but I just want to say I love hearing from people.
Thanks so much again, Peter. We appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye now.
Bye.